Hopefully, we'll, our target will be done by 10 till, so we take a little recess before the regular meeting starts at 7.
All right, well, we'll start tonight with evaluating code enforcement, and Tim Teddy needs no introduction, so I'll just pass it off to Tim.
Thank you, Mr. Mathis, Mayor, members of the council. Appreciate the opportunity to speak to you tonight and probably mostly listen and try to answer your questions about the topic of code enforcement. I have just a few opening remarks to make and then a short presentation that might put in mind some questions besides the ones that you've already got in mind to ask us. I brought two of the key staff in community development that deal fairly directly with code enforcement matters on a daily basis. To my left is Lee Britt, Office of Neighborhood Services, and to my right is Shane Creech, the Building and Site Development Manager. Lee, of course, works on the neighborhood code enforcement side of things, as well as a number of other duties. Shane is mainly running the permit operation, which I suppose you could consider code enforcement in the broadest sense, but there are periodically complaints and necessary enforcement of the ordinances that have to be done as part of that activity. So if I may, just a few kind of overview type remarks to kind of give you a sense of how community development as a city department approaches code enforcement. First of all, our department mission, we've talked about this since we formed in October as a management team, and what we've kind of put together is this theme of helping our citizens and customers plan, build, and care for the city. That's really what we're here to do, planning, building, caring. The code enforcement is probably best thought of as part of the caring for, but it's certainly not the only activity. It's complementary to some other things, like the volunteer recruitment that's done on the neighborhood services side of the department, the neighborhood organization work that division does, our community development and housing grants that can assist people of low income with repairing, replacing, rehabilitating their homes, or help agencies build neighborhood infrastructure. And activities like revitalization planning and historic preservation, which is really a planning and education activity, as well as sometimes a regulatory matter. There's really four components to a successful code enforcement program. There's the prevention. Think of this as the stop signs and the speed limit signs that tell you how to behave on the road. If we publicize what's considered to be community-appropriate behavior in the realm of property maintenance, we'll gain some compliance just from having publicized what our standards are and what our ordinances demand of our citizens. Intervention is a big part of it. This is the organizational infrastructure to report violations, do inspections to verify that there are, in fact, violations of city code, make appropriate notifications to property owners and other parties that are expected to comply. There's the resolution activity, and this is the part of the organizational infrastructure that determines when something is resolved, either by penalty, by voluntary abatement, by a hearing process, sometimes dismissal of a complaint. And then there is the ongoing assessment, which we're really just getting into, as are the other departments, as part of our ICMA Performance Institute performance measurement process. Just a listing of the ordinances, I think this comes pretty close to capturing those that community development deals with. Code enforcement is not the exclusive activity of any one department, including our own, but these are the ones that we deal with probably on a weekly basis. You'll hear a lot about the 2009 Property Maintenance Code, which was adopted with a number of amendments in what's known as Article 7 of the City Building Code, or Chapter 6 of the City Code. There's the Rental Conservation Law, which is part of Chapter 22, which is the Public Works chapter. Article 5 is the rental conservation law that requires all rental properties to be inspected. There's two sections of the health and sanitation chapter, those that define what is considered per se a nuisance in the city. There's certain activities and displays of objects that aren't tolerated in the city. They've been declared a nuisance, and that's in that code. There's several things that are considered to be aesthetically offensive, so there's an aesthetics section to Chapter 11. Community development currently enforces those parts of the city code in the neighborhood response team area, which, of course, is central city neighborhoods. The health department enforces it in the city in general. The 2009 building code, the 2009 international building code, we think of this as code enforcement when a building is not built according to plan or it violates one or more of the processing requirements. Perhaps construction starts without a permit. So that would be another ordinance that might be invoked in a code enforcement situation. The zoning ordinance is far-reaching, of course, and that's the allowed uses and placement of structures by district throughout the city, but some of the frequently referred to parts in the code enforcement context are I'll list in just a moment. And then there's the International Fire Code, and of course we rely on fire department and their expertise in enforcement of that, but we may get complaints that involve Chapter 9 of the city code. Chapter 12A, land disturbance, which does a number of things. It's stormwater, it's erosion and sedimentation control associated with construction, it's tree preservation, stream buffering. So that's an environmental ordinance, really. And then there's some miscellaneous sections of the city code that take us to other chapters, like 16 for construction hours. You can only run construction equipment in the city during the hours of 7 to 7 weekdays or 9 to 5 on Saturday, that kind of thing. And section or chapter 29, which deals with streets and public places, section of that deals with dirt and debris on public streets, which of course sometimes we have to enforce construction of a subdivision. And then there's signs, the dimensional standards and location standards for signs. That's another thing we might get complaints on. This is a chart that just kind of indicates the general process. It's hard to generalize because each code has a little different requirement for who is the responsible or how we process those complaints. But the process does start with a complaint. It might be initiated by citizens. It might be initiated by staff. It might come to us staff through the council, of course. And there follows an investigation, usually an inspection, that might find that there's not a violation. And so we might dismiss that. And so that's one of the things we're going to begin tracking is the number of dismissals based on the overall number of complaints that we get. If a violation is found, the general procedure is a notice is prepared and sent that informs the controlling party that they are in violation. Almost invariably, they're given some option to appeal that. So one path that might take is to an appeal body. So for example, a rental inspection finds that the property maintenance code is violated in the rental property. That individual does have the option of citing a hardship or unique circumstance going to the Building Construction Codes Council as an appeal. If the direction is either admission or denial that it is a an offense, we'll then move into a period of time where we reinspect based on that original violation notice. If the property is in compliance at that time, obviously then the case can be closed. If reinspection shows that there's been some progress made towards abating the problem, we may allow an additional period of time to completely close out the complaint. Or if there's no progress, it may go to court or an administrative hearing. If it goes to court, then of course the decision is either going to be a penalty in favor of enforcement of the ordinance, or the complaint may be dismissed. You'll notice there's another track here that's based on the health and sanitation process. We put that in just to show that there is some difference in the way these things occur. I think there should be an additional box, actually, for a director hearing, because that is something that will be part of that process. But basically, after contact is made, the city will move into abating that violation at city expense if necessary, if there is not a, an abatement on the part of the property owner or responsible party. And if necessary, that cleanup cost may be tax billed to property owner. Two categories of common types of complaints and or violations. Not all, every complaint, of course, is a violation, but these are the things that are heard in the area of maintenance, the condition of existing properties. Building exteriors are in poor condition. That's probably a property maintenance code item. Rental property in poor condition in the habitable areas. Now, that's something we police as part of the rental inspections process, which of course is on an inspection cycle. Unlicensed rental property, we do have to make a certain amount of effort to make sure that everybody that's leasing property for rent, for residential in the city, does get a proper license. Weed, debris, junk in the yard, basically poor housekeeping around the building, not just the condition of the building itself, but that's a common complaint. Unauthorized use of building or land. We hear a lot about things like the next line, the home occupation in the residence. We do have an ordinance that allows it, but up to only a certain limit. So we do get calls about business being carried out in a neighborhood. Too many occupants. This is, as council's aware, probably one of the more difficult things to enforce. But there's sometimes secondary effects that can be enforced when there's too many adults living in a home. That's part of the zoning ordinance that covers that. Improper parking, which may be parking on a lawn or another surface that's not designed and located for parking. And accessibility problems. Disabled can't get access to a building, perhaps. In the construction phase, a little bit of a shorter list, but of course probably a lot of complaints from time to time on these things. Starting work without a permit does happen once in a while. Excessive storm runoff or concerns that construction on a site is unleashing flooding stormwater runoff on a neighboring property. Ineffective erosion and sedimentation control. Perhaps there's sediment leaving the site. It's a concern not necessarily with its impact on neighboring property as the effect on surface water. So we do get those complaints. Construction hours violations, dust, noise, mud on the streets, and incomplete infrastructure and site improvements. So we do handle a variety of things, and sometimes these come in combinations. A little bit about our resources. In the ONS division, there are three dedicated building inspectors and environmental health specialist, plus a half-time police officer and a half-time assistant city councilor, plus the necessary office clerical and management support. On the building and site side, three site inspectors and four building inspectors. The site inspectors are assigned to different areas in the city, and they do inspect land disturbance areas where grading has occurred, perhaps for a new subdivision or new commercial development. And then they also look after the subdivision infrastructure after it's built, before Public Works has accepted the streets as public streets. And of course, you have a ministerial item on your agenda quite frequently where you are taking on new streets and infrastructure that's been transferred. The inspectors on the building and site side primarily are engaged in doing the several thousand inspections that are done a year in not in responding to complaints, but in the ordinary course of doing building permits, overseeing new construction. But they will respond if there are complaints in commercial areas about problem properties or if there's a problem with the building itself that's under construction. And of course, we collaborate a lot with other departments. It's really an interdisciplinary area. Each of these does its own, what I'd call, code enforcement. But periodically, in the context of a specific property, we're asked, is it properly licensed for business, if it's a business? Is there a health code violation? I was reading about a house in St. Charles that had an issue with snakes and rats and mice this week. Well, we as a department aren't skilled to handle that, so we're going to call animal control and Stephanie's department if that scenario plays out here. So there's a lot of collaboration that's needed, and sometimes we may need to call in other agencies if there's hazardous material involved. Just a quick indication of our level of activity so you kind of get a sense of the order of magnitude of things. In ONS for fiscal year 2011, they report nearly 2,400 code enforcement cases. So these would be individual properties that are involved in a code enforcement situation. There might be multiple sections.
Right, that could be health, property maintenance, over occupancy, any of those kind of cases.
There might be multiple sections written up, but one case might contain all of that.
When you say a case, is that just something that you're looking into, or is that something that's actually referred to the court system?
In between, I think. It's one where there's been...
Yes, it's anything that's been reported to us or staff have seen. Not all of those have been sent to municipal court because the vast majority were able to resolve voluntarily.
Within the residential rental program, there's 24,000 registered units in almost 9,000 buildings. So you can see there's a lot of single-family homes being rented as well that are registered. In fiscal 2011, there were 691 new applications to the rental program, so that continues to grow. And I'll show that about two-thirds were voluntary. Number were code enforcement cases themselves, where we informed owners that they needed to register their properties.
Tim?
Yes, sir.
Do you have any idea, estimate of what percent of rental property is registered?
We think about 95%.
Yeah, it's a little difficult to get our arms around. It's something that we're constantly looking to make sure that we capture properties that are not registered. Looking at census data, that would tell us that over 95% are registered. Take that for what it is. Again, we are able to look at utility information and also to continue to raise awareness about our rental conservation law so that we can really on a constant basis try to identify those new properties and get them registered.
Within the last 18 months, there's been 10 vacant or dilapidated houses that have been demolished by owners. And again, those are pressure from code enforcement staff because they're vacant and dilapidated, buildings that really were beyond saving. Continue to pursue buildings that are in that condition where they are a detriment to neighborhoods because they simply are not non-performing properties. There's been some success reducing the rental inspection backlog. In a year's time, that's been reduced to one-sixth of what it was. Shifting to the construction side, erosion control front, see there's just about 4,000 total inspections that occur, and this is in a calendar year, actually, not the fiscal year. In a calendar year, 12-month period, nearly 4,000 inspections. That yielded 66 notices of violation. Those are first notices. Generally, compliance is had after that first notice of violation, so the number of second notices much reduced from that. I think it's we get pretty good compliance on those.
And what caused the reduction in backlog of inspections on rentals?
We made some changes in neighborhood services. We added a half-time ASA, administrative support person, and she is able to work on scheduling the inspectors. Previously, the inspectors were doing their own scheduling and their own mailings, all their own administrative work, and so we've shifted that to someone who is exclusively working on that. So that's freed up the inspectors to spend more time in the field.
Has the missed appointment fine helped? Is it enforced? You missed the appointment?
Yes, it's $15.
It's helped the...
Yes, and the other thing that this administrative person is doing, she's also making reminder calls, and so that's reduced the number of missed appointments, and we think that's helped too.
Two pie charts, I'll go light on the data. This will give you an idea of where the complaints come from, and actually, close to a majority of them, 47%, are the result of city inspections. Now, these data do not come from the rental conservation or rental inspections program, except in the sense that 7% of complaints do come from tenants. We have a form that we make available to a tenant that has a concern that their apartment unit or rental unit is appropriately maintained. But generally, these are more the ordinary complaints about property that people see in their neighborhood, come in contact with during their daily business. 28% are citizen complaint. So we can't really say that the property maintenance code is a complaint-driven instrument. I mean, we do accept complaints, but we also try to be proactive. And one of the proactive targeted programs that you're well familiar with is the neighborhood response team area. So that's yielded 18%. Of our city's code enforcement cases. So that's within a, I can't recall anymore what the square mileage is, but that's a minority of the square miles of the city, but obviously some of the city's oldest neighborhoods. This is prosecutions. I know we get questions about it a lot, and perhaps it's a council concern. Why isn't more of this happening? Why aren't there more fines and this kind of thing? This is, again, for fiscal year 2011, and this is the total number of prosecutions by code category. Property maintenance is the greatest share of that, 200 out of the total. 114 are illegal rental, and then several health in the NRT, and then five zoning cases been prosecuted. So those are the ones that make it to the court for
Tim,
prosecution.
Tim, what is the illegal rental exactly? What is that category?
A property that has not been registered with the city.
Not a registered rental.
And we're not able to get them. We do give the owner an opportunity to come in and make registration, and so after we've given them plenty of time to come in and they still haven't made application, then they'll be sent to court, and that's what those
are. Do you have any data on what the prosecutions are for over-occupancy violations?
I think that's probably what this five is from last year. In the previous year, it was greater. I don't have that number with me, but...
So it's small. Okay.
Those cases are difficult to build.
I know. No, I know. I'll wait to ask my questions till you finish.
Just a few discussion topics. We anticipate some discussion of mobile home parks. I think that's really what precipitated our appearance on the agenda tonight is the difficulties with the Regency. I'm here to report now that ONS has begun putting mobile home parks on all mobile home parks on an inspection schedule. So make a regular appearance going through them, and that is not just a complaint-driven affair. So that is being done in the category of visibility and transparency, and kind of going back to that first principle of prevention. Staff have suggested that perhaps we map the complaints that are out there, that is the cases that are out there, so that people can go to a map and see that, well, there is something happening with the property there, and it wouldn't necessarily be that informative other than it would let someone know that someone had already reported a complaint with that property. And then as they go through the stages in the process, we could change the coding for those properties. So we will offer that as an idea.
As an idea. What I was wondering is if it would work with the current parcel viewer software that's available to the public, that they could click on.
Yeah, since
a different system.
Well, anything that has an address can be mapped, so these things are always going to be organized by address, I would think, yes.
We have a marvelous GIS system, and that might help create some transparency.
Do we need to, this is more of a question, do we need to evaluate our reliance on voluntary compliance? You saw in the pie chart there are only four categories, so we're not taking a lot of folks to court, we're not fining a lot, we're not ticketing a lot. We do put notices of violation out there, and through a process of repeat visits with the inspector, usually we'll get compliance. Most cases, there'll be those that are obstinate or feel that they have a strong case against us, but that's been kind of the status quo in code enforcement, so I'll just put that out there as a question. Access to problem properties, that's another thing that we do struggle with. We do have to get search warrants if we're going to go into a property to verify that it is, in fact, a dangerous structure, unless there's some circumstance that makes it very obvious that that's creating a danger, an immediate or imminent danger to public well-being. We've discussed turf issues, and by this I don't mean any antagonism or tension between departments, but just to state a fact that code enforcement is an activity that spread across departments and divisions. And is there some way we can centralize it or make it more so of a one-stop? So we've been given some thought to that. One suggestion is we form and community development lead a code enforcement team that would consist of not just our own staff, but staff of other departments that are, I'd call them our frequent flyers on code enforcement cases from these other departments, similar to what we do in the development area with, we have a concept review team that draws from a large number of departments that weighs in on development plans. We
can
exchange ideas and approaches and also resolve those turf questions so we don't have problem properties falling through the cracks because
one
department feels the other is taking the lead on it.
Well, and one thing that's difficult for the citizens that I hear a lot of and is that they say one department tells them, one guy comes from the city and tells them to do something else and somebody else comes from the city and tells them to do it differently or to stop doing what the first guy said, and it's never in writing. And some of this is miscommunication or misunderstanding on the part of the citizen, but, you know, I think that was the idea of combining all of this was to so that you can say, hey, I talked to so, you know, if you're dealing with the same person and then that person decides, okay, well, we're going to do it this department's way and not that department's way. Because especially for people that are doing remodeling, I hear this a lot. One inspector will come out and say, go ahead, no paperwork. Next day, another one comes out and says, stop. So I don't know. I'm sure you're fully aware of this and you hear it too. So,
well, and we appreciate the feedback. I mean, any specific instances we hear where there's been that duplication effort, we need to know about inspection staff. We're also involved, as are all departments, in the ICMA process. These are the categories bulleted below that ICMA collects, and honestly, we don't categorize our data like they do, so we'll need to make some adjustments in our record keeping. They look at housing violations, zoning violations, nuisance, and dangerous building is probably a distinct type of nuisance, and then miscellaneous other, and they look at things like the time intervals between report of a violation and action, and how long it takes to resolve a case altogether, and also how many there are, and how many are cured through voluntary compliance versus forced compliance, to use the term that ICMA does. So that's an effort that we're participating in. The code enforcement module, a number of staff from other departments worked on it with our staff, and I think at 31 pages, it's probably the longest one out of that set. So that's all I had to present to you, just to kind of give you a flavor for what you know, what we're doing, how we're organized, and I hope you found it beneficial, but we look forward to your questions.
I'd like to ask a question. I want to thank Lee and her team for being so responsive, I have to say. I've been very impressed. My focus is going to be on the ONS only because My concern all the way along has been that maybe we are relying too much on voluntary action and not taking, not prosecuting. I think we've done a lot. I think since it's been reorganized, I think it's been very responsive, as I said, and I think with some of the changes in the, I think in Chapter 22, I think we've done some tightening up of the language on the rental conservation law that's really helped. And I guess my question is, what else do we need to do? I mean, is it a staff issue? I'm actually kind of surprised we only have a half-time prosecuting attorney, and just need to know, are we looking around to make sure that we have the toughest laws and ordinances and ways that we conduct our activities? Because I really, I get a ton of comments about over-occupancy, and is there anything else we can do in that regard? I mean, that's a terrible problem here, terrible, and affecting a lot of neighborhoods. So, anyway, I just need to know really from you what you think, how you think you're doing, and what other tools do you need, and what, can we be a little tougher on our enforcement?
I just wanted to clarify one point. The halftime prosecutor, that means time that's assigned to our department. There's other resources in law that will assist us. There's a city prosecutor, for example, whose position isn't recognized there. But I'll start. I think if we know that there's a concern that maybe we're not moving things quickly enough or decisively enough or both, we have to look at our codes and see if there are barriers to moving those things quicker or assessing fines more readily. I think we just have to do that analysis of where the snags are, because usually it's a feeling on behalf of the staff that they're not empowered necessarily.
And that's the kind of analysis, honestly, I was looking for in this report, because, that's a terrible thing to hear, that you don't feel empowered. So I really thought we were going to have the analysis tonight on that.
One of the really helpful pieces that would answer that to a large degree are the ICMA benchmarks. It would be very helpful to know, for example, what is the average? How long does it take every other city in America to take care of that issue? And where do we stand on it? So those will be very helpful once we get them.
When might that be?
I have to look at Tony. When's the ballpark where we expect the ICMA data to come back?
We have to submit all of that data to ICMA by March the 15th, so that's coming up in a couple of weeks. All the departments have been very proactive in getting them in early, so I've spent the last couple of weeks reviewing them all to make sure they're consistent. ICMA will take that data, and they'll probably spend at least a couple of months cleaning the data. So we see some initial spreadsheets and some graphs comparing our data to other peer cities, probably by midsummer. But their publication that comes out every year, which is a pretty good-sized thick book that compares all the recipients, there's about 180 cities participating in this program, that won't be out till probably close to the end of September.
So the real value of that tool is, let's just say we find a city that handles their housing complaints on an average of 14 days, and ours is quite a bit longer. We could go there and see how they do their work.
And the second question I have, and then I won't take any more time, what happened with Regency? I mean, to have that stack of complaints, have you done an overall, where did we fail as a city?
Well, again, a clarification. I think it was said at the hearing that there were 300 complaints, or there were 300 violations there. That may have been true over a period of time. At that moment, there were probably closer to three dozen that were outstanding violations, which is an impressive enough number, but the pattern out there has been a continuous pattern of enforcement, compliance. In other words, as violations were abated, others would appear in their place. And when that zoning item came to a head, too, that was a moment when, really the owner was checking out. So there was a very, very bad moment to look in on that that development. People were moving their trailers out, and leaving behind accessory structures, that's still a condition of that property. I mean, there's still a need to remove the deck structures and steps and things that have been left behind as the mobile homes are moved out. But it was in a transition.
Say it another way. I think every one of those pieces of paper is an example of the staff doing their job. So all 300 of those violations were caught by staff. We went out and looked at all of them. So when folks see that stack, that's evidence that the inspectors are out there and filing, creating those complaints. So that's what I see when I see a stack of paper that way. Staff is working hard at one place.
And yeah, I had the same concerns and questions as Ms. Anthony in terms of do you have enough staff? What do we need to do to tighten the ordinances to empower the city and you more to do your job? And with Regency, it seems like that was on a downhill spiral for quite a long time, not just when they were checking out. So I had a follow-up question. You said you were going to start doing regular inspections of mobile home parks. And what exactly does that mean? Once a year, once every 4 months?
What we've done is taken the, I believe it's 18 existing parks that we've identified within the city, and each inspector has been assigned a group of those. And what our hope is to go through those on an annual basis. They've just started doing those inspections, and so it's really too early for me to share what they're finding. One of the challenges with the mobile home parks is that, it's personal property, so it's a little more difficult to track than real property where we can get on the county's website and identify who's really responsible. And I think that's one of the challenges with Regency is that you have both tenants and the park owner, and in some cases it can be challenging to determine really who's responsible for those violations. On the health violations, it's a matter of the tenant, the person that's in control of the lot who lives in the home. But in any case, yes, we, I think, look at Regency as something that none of us want to see happen again, and so the inspectors have started going out now, and the plan is right now to go on an annual basis to visit all of those in Columbia.
And I would also be interested in what was needed in terms of the owners keeping books or paperwork so that the city can see that they keep track of who's there, who owns what, so to make your job easier so we can hold people accountable. So I'm just interested in your input on that.
Yeah, I would say that there could be some changes to the ordinance that would require managers and owners of those parks to provide that information. We currently don't require that now. It also makes it difficult to know which are owner-occupied and which are rental, because these parks oftentimes are some mix of both.
Right. I guess my question is going to be, the tone of the questioning here has been, what do you need to solve certain problems? And I've talked to both of you and your other staff about houses that are vacant for ages, and there's one up on Benton Street that I found out about during the election that have been vacant for years. And it'll be really interesting to look at this data, because what you're probably going to find is a lot of the cases are you find an owner, find an occupant, they respond, you can do something. In the house up on Benton Street is one where, I don't know, it's in foreclosure and some of the heirs are dead, and it's a very confusing situation, and they're all in Texas. So what I would imagine, that if you look at your cases, you would have several of these that are outstanding for years because you either can't find the owner or the owner is unable to do anything. And what makes me sad in Ward 1 is we get these situations, and then the house isn't taken care of, the owner's dead, the owner's in bankruptcy, the owner's in divorce, or the owner's just unresponsive. This case sits there. I've got a couple of trackers open, one for across the street from me, and you know, nothing happens. And it may be because your hands are tied. Do you need more resources? Do you need more authority? You know, how do we handle this? Do you need more pressure from the public to kind of keep an eye on these things? What's the answer? Because and you guys are submitting the data. I think it'll be very interesting to see the tail is what are the cases that go on for years and years and years and years. Then the house dilapidates. Then it has to be torn down. My constituents don't have a place to live where there was once a place to live. So. I don't know, do you remember some of the cases I'm talking about? There's a vacant house across the street from me on Ash, and there's this one on Benton Street.
411 West Ash, I think that's one.
Yeah, and, 411, and and then next to it was 413 that got torn down probably by the city, and then there's an even-numbered one on the south side of Ash, and then the one on Benton I may never have got a tracker in, but the neighbor seemed to think that it was already in the system. So, see, you'd have these cases that are lingering for years, and it's almost like they're a separate case from the, you would almost take them out and analyze them as a separate pool of, like, owner is dead, owner is in Texas and in a mental hospital, you know. What do we do there? Because you're not going to get a response, and there's no tenant because the house is vacant.
It seems there almost has to be special investigations of some of those more complicated situations. So maybe an answer is doing some kind of reporting where we report on those properties that are chronic problems that we've been unable to see movement on through our process. That could include the mobile home parks that are notorious for frequent property maintenance code violations, or it could be an individual property that's vacant. Folks are complaining about it, yet they're not seeing something happening with it. If there's a reason that we can't deal with it, maybe we just need to make that plain in a report. Say, here's on a quarterly or semi-annual basis some properties that continue to be problems, and here's the challenges we have. They might be legal. They might be a especially obstinate owner.
Right. So at least we see sort of come back to it. My, as an individual business person, I have my problem clients, and every month I go through a list, and it's sort of like the same things there from last month that just isn't getting dealt with. And you must have, you know, this in spades because, you know, it's thousands of cases. And I'm just curious, too, is this going to dovetail into the new software system that we are putting together that, I don't know if John Blattel's here or Laura Peevler, is John nodding his head? I don't know if this new software system is going to help ONS and community development.
Best of breeds addition definitely will be scoped out in our assessment firm, which we're looking at.
It'd be really interesting because I think you do have you're going to have a bimodal distribution here of the houses and the problems that just go on and on and on for years versus like Bill Canton sends me a weed notice about every couple months and I get on it and then he can check it off his list. So, you know, so we have a process there because I'm responding and taking action and I'll even call him back sometimes. And that's your typical case, and then you've got the extremes. So that'd be, well, I've gone in circles about this, but you get the idea. You get the idea of what my question is, and you know, if you need help on that, let us know.
You have any sense of the reinspection percentage for compliance?
Rental properties, it's I don't have the number, but it's probably more than half.
They have to be reinspected. At one time, we talked about having a rental owner roster in the city, and when codes changed, being able to send out a notice to the owners that these are the things the inspector will be looking for that are new. Has that ever gone anywhere?
We're handling that whenever we send out the renewal notices. We send out a newsletter with some reminders, some common violations we see, and then whenever we send out the inspection appointment, we send out a one-sheeter that does cover that. This last code cycle, there were not very many changes that affected rental property owners, and so there haven't been any drastic changes, but we do want to be sensitive to that and make sure that they know what the code says, because we don't want to do those re-inspections any more than they do. So
I think that would help with the re-inspect to get that notice.
Yeah.
The other thing is, we talked at one time about having other people do inspections, HVAC people and other companies do inspections for the city. Is that being done?
It's not being done now, but
you need it done?
Yes.
Okay.
Are you talking just about the HVAC inspections?
Well, I'm talking about the compliance for
the rental inspection itself.
HVAC and then the compliance for occupancy?
Yes.
Are you going to have that done also?
Well, that's an idea that's currently on the table. You're talking about a private third-party inspection service.
Yes.
That could do rental inspections.
Yes.
Yes. I'm sure you're going to hear more about that in the coming months.
When your backlog went from 1,200 down to 200, then maybe we don't need that service? I don't know. I mean, you're the expert.
And this would be a good time, if you have a public comment to make. If you have an opinion, please share it, if you want to share it publicly, as to whether this is a good idea and how it would work for you with your regular staff. Feel free to pass if you.
On the private inspections?
Yeah.
I think it could be a benefit. I think that one of the benefits of that is that would allow the private the property owner to select who they want to work with. There's an awful lot that will have to be done between now and then as far as determining who would qualify to be an inspector, and then also what we would have in place to audit those inspections. So I do think it would be worth pursuing, even though we don't have a very big backlog, but there's a lot of work and a lot of questions that we still have to answer.
It hadn't occurred to me that the property owner or occupant could pick the inspector. I mean, you know, that was sort of like the bond issuers can pick their rating agency, and that didn't always work out so well.
That's currently how we operate with the HVAC inspections, and they get to pick whoever off of an approved list to conduct those. That's how Boulder, Colorado does their rental inspection program. I think the key to that is having some way to audit so that we're sure that they're doing quality
right.
work.
Banks use private appraisers, and that seems to work. While we're at it, I was just on the radio with Tyree Bindham, and we were talking about both the demand for minority businesses and the supply of minority businesses, and I don't know if there would be any. I mean, there's enough moving parts here, and you're trying to do enough already, but that's just something to consider, if there would be a way to utilize some kind of, you know, have some kind of program to allow some minorities to participate in this process. And they might also be people who know the neighborhoods very well, that, you know, they don't need to look stuff up because they know who's who.
Short points. One, I want to thank the Office of Neighborhood Services for their work, and there has been a tremendous improvement in the last couple years in enforcement across the board. So we just want to know how we can help you even more, because this is a frequent area where council people get complaints, and probably most frequently affects the residents. And then I had a second thought on Mr. Kespel's comment about notice to the rental units about code changes. That's a lot of mailing. It might be good to have a little section on the web that just has a running changes this year, and then people can go there and get updated. So just a thought bouncing off of Mr. Kespel's suggestion.
Another interesting way to get at rental violations might be to contact the tenants instead of the owners. I don't know if you do that.
Tenants can come forward and make complaints, and we have a form, and we ask that they they swear to it so that it's a certified as a truthful account of the problem. But we do make that available, and there's information on the web page for neighborhood services that's directed both to tenants and to landlords. So we provide some service guidance to both.
Great.
Well, just as a sum up, so the three people you see here really represent a pretty big change in the way we do things. The creation of the Community Development Department, that's the Community Development Department right there. So the hard work, that's the easy work. The hard work is now theirs, which is to really sort of overhaul how we approach our work so that it is the most effective it can be. It's really take that idea that made ONS successful and write it large. You know, how do we stretch that across the whole service there? So I'm excited to see that. It's just getting started. Their research is ongoing about items like the private inspections. And it may be that the, you know, the cause is gone at this point to do it, the motive reason. But it's still a research that we'll finish and provide to you so you have that to consider as we move forward. There may be other reasons to do it.
I think it's worth exploring because if the economy picks up and building picks up, there is going to be a backlog on the permit side.
It's a, you bet. There are many reasons to look into it, and we will do that and get that to you. So I look forward to seeing what they do in the next year.
Thank you very much. Let's take about 5 minutes and start promptly at 7.